Hi, and thanks for listening to Here and Now Anytime. We've got new episodes every weekday afternoon, so make sure you don't miss anything by following and subscribing wherever you get your podcasts. Just look for Here and Now Anytime. Now here's the show. New music from Bjork, and a look at other women making waves in the world of classical music. It's Thursday, December 29th, and this is Here and Now Anytime from NPR and WBUR Boston. I'm Chris Bentley. Today on the show, we've got a feast for your ears. Later on, a podcast critic gives us his picks for new shows to check out, and we listen to the work of women forging gorgeous new frontiers in classical music. But first, we look at the musical trends of 2022 as they happened on one platform that's having an outsized impact on what young people especially are listening to. Here's Deepa Fernandez.
The music of TikTok is inescapable. Whether you hear it on your phone or in the background at the mall, songs that do well on TikTok usually dominate the charts and your playlists. The social media app is a power player in the music industry, with the capability to launch new stars and reignite love for long-forgotten songs. Dan Waitley is a senior media reporter at Insider, covering TikTok and social media, and he joins us once again to talk about the songs that dominated TikTok this year. Hey, Dan.
Hey.
So when we spoke to you last year, it seemed like the music industry was perhaps just waking up to the impact that TikTok was having on the charts. How have things changed in 2022?
TikTok is no longer the challenger, the newcomer. It's really become a major player in music. And I think because it's established its position in the industry, everyone is paying attention to it now. And so we see record labels and artists and other music industry folks really focusing on the platform, figuring out how they can try to make songs do well there.
Let's talk about Lizzo. She's an artist who's dominated the platform this year. According to TikTok's end-of-year report, she had the most video views in the United States. Her song, About Damn Time, which who doesn't love that song, became the soundtrack of a viral dance trend. It's about damn time. In a minute, I'ma need a sentimental man or woman to pump me up. Feeling fussy, walking in my Balenciennes, trying to bring out the fabulous. Cause I give a bump, way too much. I'ma need like two shots in my cup. Wanna get up, wanna get down. That's how I feel right now. Okay, so Lizzo is an artist who spends a lot of time on the app. She communicates with her fans via video stitches and promoting her own music. How did you see artists' time on TikTok impact their music's place on the charts?
I think artists like Lizzo that really understand the platform and know how to jump in on trends, they're seeing the most success. And I think that's one thing that really has changed this year from last year is it used to be just a few artists that were doing that, and a lot more have, you know, tapped into the platform and are spending more time really understanding trends in the app.
And some artists have also been able to use TikTok to launch a comeback for themselves, like Meghan Trainor. Her single Made You Look, which went viral on the platform in October, became her highest charting single since 2016. I could have my Gucci on. I could wear my Louis Vuitton. But even with nothing on, bet I made you look. You know, her presence on TikTok, Meghan Trainor that is intertwined with influencer Chris Olsen. She featured him in dozens of videos with her new song, and he promoted her music on his own account. How common is it to see artists and record labels partner with TikTok influencers to promote music this past year? And is it always a successful tactic?
It's very common for artists and record labels to hire content creators to promote music. It's a very popular marketing tactic. I think it's become harder to rely on a few creators to make songs really take off just because there's so many more people on TikTok than there was a couple years ago or even a year ago. And so I think that, you know, a lot of music marketers are thinking about how they can still break through. And sometimes that means hiring, you know, dozens of creators to include songs in their videos versus relying on just a few.
Yeah, and you've written about almost the flip side to this, where sometimes artists feel like they're now responsible for their own marketing and brand.
It's been a really interesting shift for performers because social media has become part of their jobs. As schedules have gotten busier for artists, they're starting to feel like things like TikTok and social media are more of a chore and less of a creative outlet. And, you know, we've heard from artists speaking publicly saying that they are frustrated or they feel like they're being pressured by their labels to produce content for TikTok. And it's, you know, kind of exhausting for them.
Well, let's look at older songs that made a comeback. The big standout this year is Kate Bush's 1985 song, Running Up That Hill. It went viral over the summer when it was featured on the fourth season of Netflix's Stranger Things. So she reportedly made $2.3 million in royalties just this year. We also heard ABBA, Earth, Wind & Fire, September on TikTok. What are you seeing with what recording labels are pushing? Older titles or new music or both?
It's one of the most interesting things that's changed with the arrival of TikTok, which is that labels are now paying a lot closer attention to their catalogs and kind of legacy songs that can really get a second life through TikTok. And it's a new business opportunity. I mean, you just mentioned a very large figure for a performer that, you know, has not necessarily been in the cultural mainstream as much lately. That's a whole new fan base for her.
So this year also saw growing popularity of sped up remixes or mashups. That's when a familiar or older song is either pitched up or sped up or layered over another song. And these remixes became popular in their own right and are often featured under videos. What's going on with these sped-up remixes? And do they affect the original song's performance on the charts?
They do affect the performance of songs. And a lot of these are mashups that are made by music producers organically. But there are instances where a music marketer or a label will actually pay a producer to create a remix of a song, just to bring it new life.
So I have to say, one of the best parts of TikTok is the fact that someone with no social capital could post a video and rise to fame. You know, this happened for 15-year-old Yaritza Martinez and her brothers, who were part of a band called Yaritza y Su Esencia. They're the children of farm workers, and the trio has spent time picking fruit. And then their song, Soy el Único, went viral on TikTok, catapulting them to fame. Let's listen. Ya déjalo ser eso que eso me dejas ir porque sabes que nadie te puede tratar como yo. Soy el único. So the group was nominated for a Latin Grammy Award, but I'm wondering if the music industry's heavy involvement in TikTok is making these kind of magical moments of organic discovery less common and kind of more manufactured.
I do think that it is harder to win the lottery as an artist. I think, you know, the way that TikTok works, you know, if you end up on the For You page, that's how you get discovered. But it's become harder to do that just because there's a lot more videos being made. And so, you know, I think we maybe are seeing fewer of those organic moments just because there are marketing dollars that are going into pushing certain tracks or certain songs. But there are still plenty of, you know, success stories of up-and-coming performers that get discovered. Maybe they get signed to a record label after they take off. The opportunity is still out there.
All right. And to take us out, choose a TikTok song for us that to you best encapsulates 2022.
Thinking about songs that rose on TikTok organically, there was a remix called Jiggle Jiggle, which was by a DJ producer duo called Duke and Jones. And basically they sampled audio, spoken word audio from an interview with Louis Theroux. And it's quite a funny track. It was really hard to miss on TikTok this year. And yeah, it's called Jiggle Jiggle.
My money don't jiggle jiggle, it falls. I like to see you wiggle wiggle, for sure. It makes me want to dribble dribble, you know, riding in my Fiat. You really have to see it. 6'2" in a compact, no slack, but luckily the...
All right, thank you, Dan Waitley, senior media reporter at Insider, covering TikTok and social media. We appreciate you being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
By the way, we've got a TikTok too. It's at Here Now Radio. Because I gotta drive, I wanna stay alive, not... Coming up, Celeste Headlee explores the year in classical music, which is a lot more than Beethoven and Mozart. Stick around.
So I can shine. Jiggle, jiggle.
We're taking a look back at the year in classical music, and that includes some music written today. We picked a few tunes from the New Yorker music critic Alex Ross's list, and he selected 10 most notable performances and 21 recordings for his 2022 list. We'll talk about women composers and performers in particular. One of them is Icelandic star Björk and her album Fossora. Music critic Alex Ross joins us now. Alex, welcome.
It's great to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
So let's start with the Renaissance and an album called Mother, Sister, Daughter, produced by a musicologist who researched women composers of that time. Let's hear some of it, and then you can tell us about it.
Yeah, so this is a Renaissance polyphony, very richly embroidered music of lines intertwining. There's a vast quantity of it from the Renaissance period. And it's a great discovery because Lois Strauss, the musicologist who put this album together, leading the group Musica Secreta, Secret Music, also did the primary research to uncover this music. And it's just a whole piece of music history, I think, which has disappeared. There's a really remarkable name here, that of Leonora d'Este. She was the daughter of none other than Lucrezia Borgia, of the infamous Borgia family. But she went into a convent and was active as a composer. Not totally clear which pieces she wrote, but the point is that in this convent, women were able to make music amid a culture that was generally hostile to the idea of female creativity.
And this is Vespere Autem Sabbati, attributed to Leonora d'Este. So let's move forward to contemporary ages, and let's talk about the recording I Am a Tree, I Am a Mouth. This comes from an Australian-American composer, Jane Sheldon, and this is the track called Through Massive Mountains. Let's take a listen. I think that is the composer herself singing there. What do you like about this album?
Yeah, well, Jane Sheldon, who was a discovery for me this year, is one of a number, large number, of important early 21st century composers, mostly women, who are building pieces around their own singing voices. And this is a tradition that goes back to Meredith Monk and Laurie Anderson in the 1960s, 70s, and 80s. but, you know, also goes much, much further back to the great 12th century German abbess Hildegard of Bingen. And she happens to be a major influence on Jane Sheldon and her whole approach to making music in this somewhat mystical, otherworldly atmosphere. She's working with her own voice and layering it on top of these drones and gong tones. There's an avant-garde aspect, as well as this connection to the deep history of chant. And I find it a really enticing and seductive combination of sounds.
We have a couple more to listen to, and again, this is just scratching the surface of your list. But I have to ask about the demographics of your choices, because the ones that we're playing here, for certainly, and the vast majority of the recordings you've chosen, features music by white composers. Are we still not getting enough recordings of composers of color?
No, there are a lot coming out. It happens that in my list of live performances, 4 out of 10 composers there were people of color. But I could also have chosen Florence Price, whose symphonies were very beautifully recorded by the Philadelphia Symphony this year. Remarkable recent releases by Taishan Sori, a really major avant-garde Black composer who was on my live performance list. So yeah, that's a very active sphere as well. Somehow this year in my list, I was focusing a lot on women, both as composers and as performers, and thinking about just how fertile a moment we are in for women making music, writing music. I think if I were to name leading composers of today, I would end up having a list mostly of women. I just feel like there's this explosion of creativity happening.
Let's hear one more piece of music. This is from an album by just a gorgeous mezzo-soprano named Joyce DiDonato. The album is called Eden, so named because every piece on it is somehow connected to the earth. And we're going to hear a little bit from an aria by the Czech composer Josef Myslivicek. And he was a contemporary of Mozart. If you're interested, people should look up his biography, quite the character. But this comes from his opera Adam and Eve. So let's hear Joyce DiDonato here. Clear articulation there from her. What makes this album so good?
Joyce DiDonato is just one of the great singers of our time, such a superb vocalist, but also so dramatic, so expressive. And she really loves to engage with our lives, what's happening right now. Eden is a project that emerged from the pandemic, from the sense of this collective crisis, and also from the ongoing climate crisis, and also from a sense of the rediscovery of the natural world that so many of us experienced when everything quieted down, you know, in those first weeks of the pandemic. So there's a kind of meditative quality here, meditation on nature and the power of nature. But also there's rage, there's anger, and, you know, mezzo voices, the lower female voice is always very good at that kind of roaring rage.
Yeah, they get to dig in.
So the aria by Myslivicek is from his opera Adam and Eve, and it's the voice of God enraged. I'll loose the sea from its shores, I'll erase whole cities and peoples. So there's obviously a certain contemporary relevance there as well.
Alex Ross is the music critic for The New Yorker, and we have been listening to just a few of his most notable recordings of 2022. There are lots more to dig into as well. Alex, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for inviting me. It's great to be here.
Coming up next, looking for some new podcasts to add to your playlist? We've got some recommendations after the break. Like podcasts, you're listening to one right now. Producer Gabrielle Healy likes them too. That's why she called up Nick Kwa, the podcast critic for Vulture and New York Magazine, and yes, podcast critics are a thing, and asked for some recommendations for new shows that dropped this year. You know, something to listen to after you've already subscribed to Here and Now Anytime, rated us on Spotify and Apple, and listened to all our episodes. Anyway, here's Scott Tong.
So, Nick, before we ask you about some specifics on your list, any big new podcast trends in 2022?
Well, new is an interesting one. So, you know, you have the usual trends that there were a lot more celebrity podcasts this year, more true crime, more fiction podcasts that were obviously designed to be television scripts. But it was also, I thought, sort of an interesting year for narrative podcasts. Like, we had a few knockout investigative shows like The Trojan Horse Affair and Bone Valley. But it was also this interesting subtrend of, like, shows that were essentially family histories. And we'll talk about one in a bit, but it's been a sort of really interesting interior year.
Let's talk about that. This is the first podcast we're going to talk to you about on your list. The first is Mother Country Radicals. The host is Ziad Ayers-Dorn. And if those names ring a bell, he is the son of the 1960s radicals Bernadine Dorn and William Ayers. They were part of what was called the Weather Underground organization that was on the run from the FBI. So Ziad grew up in hiding. Let's listen.
What's it like having me do this kind of research into your past?
It's wonderful that you're interested even, really. It scares me.
What does that mean?
Well, if I think, you know, by you doing this project, you've made me think, you know, are there secrets, what to keep as a secret and what not to keep?
Well, Nick, of the three we're going to talk about, this is my favorite because I have had almost the exact same conversation with my mom. You know, chasing my own family history and, you know, going around the world and asking questions that they find uncomfortable. But let's talk about this one. I mean, the host personalizes, this goes back to what you're talking about, personalizes this late 60s, early 70s important window in American history with political activism around. And here we are again having a national conversation about overthrowing the government in a very different context. Why did you put this on your list?
So, you know, there are many ways in which a project like this, you know, it's really hard to make it work, right? On the one hand, it's a sprawling story. You know, the Weather Underground is, you know, is a very sort of complicated thing to talk about. And it existed within what at the time was sort of really complicated and complex web of other sort of multiple overlapping undergrounds. And there was this sort of feeling in the air at the time that Dorn captures really well about the sense of, you know, political frustration and possibility. And so, you know, you have in that clip that interesting moment that sort of, the thing that like is quite universal, which if you ever sat down and talked to your parents about, hey, what did you used to believe in? What did you used to do? Yeah. And it's such a remarkable way into, you know, a really potent emotional historical moment. And of course, yes, there's the connections to today. And of course, you know, there's always this sort of feeling of what is a political possibility in 2022. And, you know, in addition to everything else, it's also a pretty good, fascinating reminder that people dreamt differently at some point in time.
Okay, podcast number two. Welcome to Provincetown. That is a town in Cape Cod that becomes a queer mecca every summer. The host is Mitra Kaboli. Here's a bit of the trailer.
Everyone's on stage.
Literally, CNBC, and that's everyone's motto in P-Town.
There's nothing like the energy, the force, the sheer power of people screaming at you and clapping at you and cheering at you.
And I want to introduce one of the absolute finest. Would you please welcome Miss Kaya Kristal?
That is just like, Whoa.
Now, Nick, I have to say, I came for the whoa, right, for the personalities. I did not stay for the story, at least in episode one, and then I listened to parts of episode two. I'm still, I don't know, waiting for the tension or what's at stake, the arc of the story. What was I missing?
I love that you said that, because my relationship to the show, the reason why I felt so strongly about it, it's because there's none of that.
there's none of that.
So there's a there's a way to think about narrative podcasts, right? And sort of when you kind of sit down and listen to a radio story or a sort of long form audio documentary, that you're looking for like the plot, the mystery, the question, the tension. With Provincetown, you know, you're just being. You're just kind of watching these characters with Mitra Kaboli. You're observing them, and, you know, it's kind of, the way that I've described it, it's that it's a little bit audio verite, a little bit travel journal. You got to kind of like, it's a bit of a travel documentary a little bit. You kind of just pop into this world that Mitra kind of like walks you through and just sort of get glimpses of these lives. And, you know, it's not a thriving, you know, propulsive plot or experience in any way. But it's one of those things where, you know, if you just want to step outside for your life a bit, you know, it's a lovely project to do that.
Okay, we're going to close with some gossip, as in the podcast Normal Gossip. So you get an anonymous gossip story from the real world. That's how this works. It's told by the host Kelsey McKinney to a range of guests. And every episode starts in a similar way. So pay attention, all of you, to this next clip for a familiar voice.
Tell me, Sam, what is your relationship with gossip?
I love it. I mean, I grew up a church kid, so gossip was like next to Bible. You know, I think that like a lot of people on gossip for a few reasons, but I think that in actuality, it serves a few distinct purposes that are necessary in functioning societies. Particularly the smaller the group, you have to have a certain set of norms that are followed for the group to get along. Mm-hmm. And I find that what gossip does is that it is a check on making sure that those norms are followed.
That, of course, is Sam Sanders, the former NPR host, sharing his relationship to gossip. Sam, he's now your colleague at Vulture, Nick.
Oh, yeah.
I listened to one episode, you know, where a person joins a knitting group and she secretly finds the bossy host of this group is a hypocrite, that the host publicly is all about earth-friendly wool, except then she's found to use mass market wool with pollutants. And the question of the gossipy group is, what do you do? Do you confront? Do you expose? Is that why this podcast, you think, works?
Oh, absolutely. So I assume you're, do you like gossip, Scott?
Do I like gossip? Do I like cookies? I mean, yeah, come on.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, what is news if not verified gossip? Normal Gossip, hosted by Kelsey McKinney, produced by Alex Sujan-Auckland. The show has this really elemental pleasure. Each episode, Kelsey kind of delivers this robust, anonymized piece of gossip to a guest. The important thing is that the gossip, as you sort of outlined there as an example, is ultimately banal. Like, these are stories both from and about perfectly ordinary strangers. And they tend to be the kind of stuff that, like, you know, gets a good group chat going. You know, you got dating mishaps, you got inexplicable behavior, and like with the knitting scene, like it's about social scene breakdowns a little bit. And you know, Kelsey's a great storyteller. She does this thing where she like really takes you every twist and turn and complication of a good piece of yarn. And there's just utter catnip. I we live in a time of incredible celebrity gossip, and a lot of that's outlandish. A lot of that is fantastical. But there's something just pleasurable about hearing like a normal other person's, another stranger's like business. That's just the good stuff.
Nick, before we let you go, we've asked you about three of them. Give us a couple more on your list that you want to put out there and suggest we check out.
I just want to give a shout out. You know, we were talking a little bit about shows that feel non-traditional or, you know, could only exist on the internet or something. There's a little tiny show that I love called Frog of the Week. And it is exactly what it sounds like. Every week, a host kind of talks through a different frog that she sort of found, researched, and provide little fun facts and little sort of sound clips. It's just adorable.
That's Nick Kwa. He is podcast critic for Vulture. Nick, thanks for sharing your picks with us, and happy listening.
Thanks for having me.
Well, this podcast comes from the team behind Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston. And let me make a recommendation that Scott must have been too modest to include in his conversation with Nick Kwa. In addition to Here and Now Anytime, we've got two other podcasts. They're both narrative special series in which Scott dives into the hidden histories of Nixon's visit to China and Reagan's campaign against the EPA. Our five-part series looking back 50 years since Nixon's visit to China and why it still matters is called The Great Wager. And if you want to explore the story of how conservatives tried to sabotage the Environmental Protection Agency in the 1980s, check out Captured. You can find both The Great Wager and Captured wherever you get your podcasts. They're in the same place as this show, so scroll back in our feed or head to hereandnow.org. Today's stories were produced by Koyani Saxena, Adeline Sear, and Gabrielle Healy. Our editors today are Gabe Bullard and Todd Munt. Technical direction from Mike Moschetto, Max Liebman, and Caleb Green. Theme music by me, Mike, and Max. Our digital producers are Allison Hagen and Grace Griffin. By the way, did you miss yesterday's episode? Allison and Grace shared some of this year's biggest stories online. Scroll back and check out if you didn't hear that. And the executive producer of Here and Now is Carleen Watson. Thanks for listening. See you tomorrow.